email ray@rte.ie. The Ray Darcy Show on RTE Radio 1.
Yeah, Wham! The Singles, Echoes from the Edge of Heaven has all the hits and it's out now. Bad Boys, Club Tropicana, Wake Me Up Before You Go Go, Freedom, Last Christmas, Everything She Wants, I'm Your Man, all there, all there. And of course, there's the wonderful new documentary which landed last week or the week before on Netflix about Wham's meteoric rise to fame and originally started the band with his good friend George Michael, and Andrew's on the line now. How are you doing, Andrew?
Yes, well, thanks, Ray. Thank you for having me on.
Yeah, that's Edge of Heaven there playing out in the background. Congratulations on the documentary. It's very good. Very, very good. Are you happy with
it? Yeah, very much so. Quite overwhelmed by the response, in actual fact. You know, I think universally it's been almost universally received with even greater warmth and affection and than perhaps we might have imagined. And I think it's touched people in a way that that hadn't perhaps expected. Chris Smith, the director, I think has been very clever in contextualizing the account of Wham by our friendship, which, you know, is an authentic representation, because essentially, you know, Wham was so inextricably about our youth and our friendship as we grew up, that the two things are wholly entwined. And then to use just George's voice and my own as the narration, I think also gives it an intimacy and a conversational casualness. People have said that they feel that they're listening. It sounds very present.
Yes, yeah, yeah. And you get a real sense of that beautiful friendship, love between yourself and George Michael.
Yes, I think Chris has been very... he's come as close as anyone, I think, to identifying the kind of unique aspect of Wham that made it so attractive and perhaps stood it apart from some of its contemporaries. And that was essentially that bond of friendship.
And what age were you when you met Andrew?
We were 12. It was the second year of secondary school. But I think it was 1974, in fact. So,
and,
yeah.
And he was the new boy. Were you asked to mind him or did you opt to mind him?
Well, I was the only one that did put their hand up, but I put my hand up. Yeah, the teachers, as I'm sure lots of your listeners are aware of, that teachers always wanted a mentor for the new kid. So, yeah, I put my hand up. I was the only one that put my hand up. So it was sort of a sealed deal.
And what was it? What was it that made you put your hand up on that day in 1974?
Simply because I'd never had a new boy, a new pupil entrusted to me. And I think probably thought it might relieve the boredom of school, to be honest.
And there's lovely footage of you as you set out to be pop stars. And you refer to George Michael as Yog. Is it Y-O-G?
Yeah.
Why Yog?
Well, the Greek pronunciation of his name and any Greek speakers amongst your listeners and must forgive me, but his name was Yorgo Panaotu, and he was introduced to the class as Yorios, and no one had any idea what that was. And his family called him Yorgo, and that sounded like yogurt. So which he wasn't very keen on, and then it was shortened to Yog. So, and he was always Yog to his close friends from that point forward.
The director was very lucky that your mum was an avid, nearly obsessive collector of clippings in her scrapbooks.
Indeed, yeah. There are 51 of them, and 51. They are a fantastic, they're a fantastic resource to refer to and to give substance to a lot of the circumstances around pivotal moments in our career. So a wonderful thing to have, and I hope at some point to be able to present them in some form to our fans and the public.
What a great archive. What a great exhibition. At what stage then, yourself and Yog, 12 years old, doing the things that 12-year-olds do, and then into your teenage years, you were a bit of a tearaway. George's dad thought you were a bad influence, all beautifully depicted in the documentary. At what stage then did music become a part of your lives?
Oh, well, almost instantly, really, from the day we met, we were obviously finding out what each other's likes and dislikes were. And it soon became very clear very quickly that we shared a really intense and broad love of music and contemporary music. And so that was one of the pillars upon which our friendship was based, that and a very puerile shared sense of humour.
There's some lovely home videos of you messing around, and it's really endearing. So then Wham was the name came out of something that happened in a club one night. You released your first single, didn't do much. Second single, didn't do much. It was languishing at 42. Then you get that call to go on Top of the Pops, isn't it?
Yeah, it was making its way up the charts after a stroke of good fortune getting a TV show, a kids' TV show on a Saturday Superstore.
Right.
But it had stalled at number 42, and Top of the Pops would debut new entries into the top 40, but you had to be in the top 40, and we were tantalizingly close, but you know, but it might as well have been a million miles away. And then another act drops out, and I'm led to understand that it was Waheed that had to drop out for some reason, and we were the next highest riser, and so we got the call. I may or may not be true that it was Waheed, but I was informed of that last night, in actual fact. But
right.
So that was the big break. Obviously, you know, Top of the Pops was, for those that don't know, was the only chart show. It was the only music show aside from the old Grey Whistle Test, and it was certainly the only pop orientated music show on TV. And it attracted viewerships of up to, I think, 15 million at its peak. It would obviously would average sort of between 8 and 11, I think. And so it was a huge opportunity to present yourselves to the British public, and they took to us very, very quickly after that appearance. So
if anybody go to YouTube and watch the first performance of Young Guns by Wham. Hey sucker,
well, I haven't seen your face around town a while, so I greeted you with an annoying smile. When I saw that girl upon your arm, I knew she'd won your heart with a fatal charm. I said, soul boy, let's hit the town, send a hey boy.
And it just jumped off the screen, that performance, because the youthful energy, good looking, just there was a freshness and a rawness about the whole thing.
Yes, I think there was. Amateurishness, actually, was what I think I'd define it. It was certainly authentic. The dance routine and the presentation was born out of our PAs that we undertook because Innovision felt that we needed to build up some sort of fan base and project ourselves when we didn't have TV and radio on our sides and doing it for us. So we went around the country performing in various clubs and we conceived the routines from dance moves that we developed on the alternative new romantic dance floors of clubs, of the suburban clubs of London. So
yeah.
It was amateur, but it was authentic, and it was very different from that which anyone else was doing.
Lovely little details in the documentary, which is available on Netflix, like George Michael was colourblind. might explain some of the outfits, but what's your excuse?
unfortunately, I don't have that excuse. Yes, a momentary lapse of sanity, let's call it.
Now, people remember Club Tropicana, the video was shot in Ibiza. That was a big song for you. But it was also a big moment in your relationship with George, because he came out to you when you were filming the video in Ibiza.
Yeah, Club Trop was the single that allowed us to throw off the constraints or the last vestiges of teenage rebellion, the trilogy that was Wham Rap, Young Guns and Bad Boys, which rather sort of painted us as class warriors with a social conscience, which Wham Rap was purely a comment on our wry look at the circumstances of worklessness, and rather painted ourselves into a corner with Bad Boys. George hated it because he felt that he was compelled to write it as a formula to follow up on the success of Young Guns, which is true, and he disliked the artistically the fact that he had to do it. It's a good track. It's a good dance track, and it sounds really good, but he dislikes the inauthenticity of it and the slightly contrived nature of it. But Club Trop liberated us from all of that. We threw those shackles off and became, and as I say in the documentary, you know, that was the unveiling of Wham in its purest form. Jörg chose that moment after we'd shot the video, and we were having a couple of days R&R after the shooting of the video to tell Shirley and I that he felt he was homosexual rather. He was still seeing women at the time. He had girlfriends, which he continued to do, but I think he come to the realization that he was a gay man rather than a bisexual one at that point. Not that it made any difference to any of us, but he felt that he needed to tell us.
And Wham's, I suppose, audience, their fans, were predominantly young teenage girls. And did he discuss with you how the fans would react if he came out to them?
No, I think whilst we had a lot of teenage girls as fans, yeah, there are a lot of other fans besides. But no, the only things that mattered with regard to him telling us of his sexuality, breaking that news, really was the context of us, and actually that of his relationship with his dad. I felt, and I think he felt to a degree, that there wasn't a great deal perhaps that we might lose from as Wham from an announcement, certainly in the UK, but nevertheless he was perhaps more conscious of potential problems that might cause. But the main issue was that we were very fearful of how his dad might respond.
So which is lovely, beautifully depicted again in the documentary, is he was living a lie, and he looked up to you because you were completely comfortable in your skin. You had things that he didn't have. Is that fair enough to say?
Yeah, sure it is, and he had things I didn't have.
Yes, of course.
Certainly, I think with regard, and he says it himself in the documentary. I think he saw the fact that I was confident and fairly much at ease with myself, and had a certain idea of myself. You know, he didn't, and I think to a degree that was in some ways a consequence of him being Jorgo Panayotu and not, you know, an English kid with an English name growing up. It was always my dad, he was born in Alexandria in Egypt. His mom was Italian, his dad was Egyptian Yemeni, and their family name was Zachariah, but dad changed that when he came to when he joined the RAF, and so I grew up as, you know, Andrew Ridgeley, with an absolute concrete notion of being English, and I don't think Jörg had that. You know, he was in 1974 in this British English secondary comp. Jorgos Panayotu was not, you know, no one knew what the hell, no one even knew how to pronounce it. So yeah. I think that was a factor in his struggle to form a self identity, and of course that was assisted by the persona he created, which he also mentions, that allowed him to become the artist he became, which was George Michael.
Yeah, and in the documentary it says, certain in his music, not so much in his personal life. When was the moment, Andrew, when you realised that your friend Jörg, who you were messing around with and having the crack with, that's Irish crack as opposed to, you know, the other thing. When did you realise?
I don't think he existed then, right?
Yeah. When did you realise that he was a musical genius? Because we now know that George Michael was a musical genius.
Yeah, fairly early on, really. His even to the extent of or back as far as Young Guns, because we needed a hit single after the relative failure of Wham Rap. Mm. And we had a couple of songs that we demoed that were, they might have been album tracks, but they weren't singles. And then he came and pulled the rabbit out of the hat with Young Guns, and that was a real quantum leap in songwriting ability. Yeah. and sophistication. And then he did it again with Bad Boys, and it was became clear that he had that ability and knack to do that, and a talent that far outstripped mine. So the decision for him to take on the songwriting duties was an obvious one, and one that we understood would facilitate our aims and aspirations to make Wham the biggest band it could be.
You were constantly being quizzed when you appeared on chat shows and other things about your bitterness. They constantly ask you, you know, are you bitter that George's doing all the writing? And, you know, I get a sense that you weren't at all, and you were reveling and celebrating the success of your best friend.
Well, you have a very acute sense, Ray, because, yeah, that's absolutely true. You know, I had nothing to resent or be bitter about. I was realizing a firmly held ambition, a childhood ambition, really, of being in a band with my best friend. And I was thrilled at his development as an artist. It was as an amazing thing to witness and to be a part of. And, you know, he was my best friend. I couldn't help but be absolutely over the moon for him and the successes and the achievements that he attained, gathered along the way. Yeah, so...
I'm just playing this in the background, Andrew, because is another sort of pivotal song, isn't it? Careless Whisper.
You know, it was a song that sat slightly outside of the kind of songs that we were writing. The sort of songs that defined Wham. Mm. And it was always a bit of an outlier. It was a track that it was one of the first three tracks that we wrote, and it was I'd been mucking around with chord inversions, and I said to Jörg, you know, I've got this chord sequence that I think would really lend itself well to a ballad, which wasn't the sort of thing that we were writing at all. They weren't the sort of tracks that we were envisaging our music as at that point in time. So it was always whilst we knew it was the jewel in the crown, we always wondered, certainly initially, how we might ultimately, made public. So as his career developed and it became obvious, his songwriting developed, I think it became obvious that he was one day going to have to step beyond Wham to fulfill his potential and as a songwriter and as an artist. Careless Whisper was the obvious springboard for him to do that. And so when he asked me, it was at that point in time, I couldn't see any reason why not. It didn't really fit into Wham's arc of the sorts of songs and tracks that we were writing and recording and creating for Wham. Nevertheless, you know, it was a shared song, and it was on Make It Big, and it was a Wham track featuring George Michael in the mm-hmm. States. It was very much a song that we shared, and we both wrote it. So it was and George was always conscious of that. So but it was the perfect
transition, I suppose. Transition, wasn't it, from Wham?
Yeah, it was the first step on that transition. Yeah. Yeah, that's right.
People will be surprised to hear that Wham only existed for 4 years. And you had the final concert in Wembley, 1986, in front of 75,000 fans. How long did that go on for? That was it a full day concert?
We had a couple of support acts, yeah. So it was a fairly long day for the fans. Yeah. I remember, I thought we were on for an hour and a half, a couple of hours maybe.
Yeah.
But yeah, it was obviously fans were queuing up from God knows when to get into to get the best spots. So it was a glorious day. The sun shone, and it was a real atmosphere of celebration and festival.
And what about the emotions on that day for you, knowing that this wonderful experience, this dreamlike 4 years, was coming to an end?
Well, as I said, it really rather felt far more celebratory than having any sense of sadness or conclusion. It was really only when we took the last bow and turned around and walked off stage that the realization that wow, that actually is it. You know, that it all stops here. But in the build up to the show, it was one of anticipation and excitement. And even during the show, the context and the feeling of it was one of such sort of celebration and festivity that there was no room to consider any kind of element of sorrow or sadness about the whole affair, because it was just too much of a good time.
Just while we're in Wembley, let's go back a couple of years, because last week it was the anniversary of Live Aid, and George famously sang Don't Let the Sun Go Down on Me with Elton John. You did backing vocals. What are your memories of that day? Because that was one of the biggest days in music history, really, wasn't it?
Yes, it was. And it was one of the great gatherings of, you know, the world's music icons. To find oneself on stage standing next to Freddie Mercury, David Bowie, Bono, Elton John, it was quite an extraordinary experience. And the funniest bit was that there were only two mics, so everyone was squabbling over. It might only have been one mic, actually. Yeah. It's hilarious.
I saw George taking over the vocals, doing a brilliant job, and the others started looking at him sort of a little bit enviously and going, he's hogging the mic there, let me in. You know, people like Sting and Bono. Amazing. What I learned from the documentary, of course, Band Aid preceded Live Aid, and the Band Aid song, Do They Know It's Christmas, kept Last Christmas, your song, brilliant Christmas song, off the top of the charts. What I didn't know was that you and George decided to donate all the profits from Last Christmas to the Ethiopian cause.
That is the case. We'd witnessed famines in East Africa previously, through the late 60s and 70s, and it seemed a right and proper thing to do when the industry was pulling together. And so, yes, that's the case. We donated our oldies from Last Christmas.
And on Christmas, of course, it was Christmas Day when George died back in 2016. Remind us how you found out about his death.
I got a phone call from his sister, but, you know, I don't choose to remember Jörg in his death. You know, I choose to remember him in the full flow of life. And as I said at the tribute that we gave, Shirley Pepsi and I gave at the Brits, he left the best of himself for us, and the best of himself was his music and his art. So, you know, when I think of him, I think of the majestic career he had and his immense talent and the beauty of his voice and his songwriting.
Right. Well, that's the perfect way to finish up, Andrew. Wham! The singles, Echoes from the Edge of Heaven, all the hits there, and Wham! The documentary, highly recommended from here. It has a big heart and a great soul as well, and it's a lovely story of a friendship that blossomed into world beating pop stars. Andrew Ridgely, thanks so much. Thanks.
Yeah, you're very welcome, Ray. Take care. All the best. Wake me up before you go.
documentary is on Netflix. Lovely guy, Andrew Ridgeley. Bit of this, just a little bit of this before we continue. Sad. He had a lot more to give, hadn't he, George Michael? A lot more to give musically. Anyway, there you go.